I invite you to join me in the spirit of prayer. Spirit of life-giving love and love-giving life. Spirit of a surprise return to the season of winter. Spirit of sunshine that reaches us even through the cold air. We've gathered together here once again today in our special room to pay attention to the people in Japan, the people in Libya, to pay attention to our brothers and sisters, those whom we've just mentioned and those who struggle with illnesses, with transitions into new ways of life, who struggle with addictions, trying to be free. May we each count our many blessings and in awe be grateful. May we each find the healing that we need for the struggles that we face, so that we might be part of a warming, healing, and sustaining world. Let us hold this moment together in quiet. In the name of all that we hold holy, may it be so.
Our ancient reading is from the book of Luke. As Jesus and his disciples were on their way, he came to a village where there was a woman named Martha, and she opened her home to him. She had a sister called Mary, who sat at his feet, listening to what he said. But Martha was distracted by all the preparations that had to be made, and she came to him and she asked, "Lord, don't you care that my sister has left me to do the work by myself? Tell her to help me." "Martha, Martha," Jesus answered, "you are worried and upset about many things, but only one thing is needed. Mary has chosen what is better, and it will not be taken away from her." And for our modern reading is an excerpt from the poem, "Still I Rise," by Maya Angelou. Does my haughtiness offend you? Don't you take it awfully hard, because I laugh like I've got gold mines digging in my backyard. You may shoot me with your words, you may cut me with your eyes, and you may kill me with your hatefulness, but still, like air, I rise. Does my sexiness upset you? Does it come as a surprise that I dance like I've got diamonds at the meeting of my thighs? Out of the huts of history's shame, I rise. Up from the past that's rooted in pain, I rise. I'm a black ocean, leaping and wide, welling and swelling. I bear the tide, leaving behind nights of terror and fear. I rise into the daybreak that's wondrously clear. I rise, bringing the gifts that my ancestors gave. I am the dream and the hope of the slave. I rise, I rise, I rise.
I can't help but to remember back in the late 60s and the early 70s when one of the phrases that was thrown around, and I think it was a very meaningful and poignant phrase, that was that the woman most in need of liberation was the woman inside of every man, and the man most in need of liberation was that man inside the womb of every woman. And I think we just experienced something of liberation by Dennis reading those words of Maya Angelou's. So back when I began college in 1968, women's history was virtually an unknown topic in schools, or even in general public consensus or consciousness.
Then in 1987, the National Women's History Project petitioned Congress to expand the national celebration of women in history to the entire month of March. Each year, programs and activities in schools, workplaces, and communities have become more extensive. Throughout the flow of history, we know that women have been essential in any analysis of the human pageant. We might wonder then why it is that women have not been adequately represented in the records of this story. It's interesting and ironic that this month, in fact just this past week, many of us celebrated a holiday which is really the commemoration of at least one aspect of the promotion of history over the destruction of her story. This past Thursday was, of course, St. Patrick's Day. And I know that it's un-American to be non-Irish on St. Patty's Day, but all the same, St. Patrick was hardly all-American. Or was he? He is certainly a symbol of the ancient victory of patriarchy over matriarchy. Patrick went to Ireland to do battle with the indigenous religion of the goddess priest, of the goddess Bridget. The pagan religion of the goddess was represented by the snake, not a symbol of evil, but a symbol of earth and earthiness. And as the story goes, Patrick drove the snakes into the sea. And this is just one of the many, many stories from around the world about putting women in their place. These stories have cumulatively resulted in the invisibility of women from the many chapters that have been written of our story. Women's History Month is an opportunity for a do-over. Not that a do-over could possibly make things right, but what it could do is that it could lead to some sort of eventual rebalancing of the male and female energies that are both so vital to the balance of our human existence. Although our history books offered little help in affirming and promoting the inherent worth and dignity of women by their deliberate omission of them, the news media began to tell a different story to the children of my generation. I recognize others of that generation here this morning. There were several women of the world, as there have always been, who were at the forefront of the human endeavor during that time. By the 1940s and 50s, they were beginning to be recognized, and Ralph Waldo Emerson once said that we live to trifles when good persons die and we fail to mention their names. And so today I want to lift up the names of some of these women in whose shadows my own early years were cast. Throughout my childhood, I was made aware of and was able to really appreciate the indefatigable efforts of Eleanor Roosevelt, who led the United States delegation in the formation of the United Nations and in the development of its charter. Until her death in 1960, she continued to labor tirelessly on behalf of all the children of the human race. Indira Gandhi, the only woman to have been elected as a national head of state for three terms, served as Prime Minister of India for nearly two decades, from 1966 until her assassination in 1984. She was known sometimes lovingly and sometimes not so lovingly as the Iron Lady. And the hallmark of her rule was a pragmatic shrewdness. And although she did make many enemies along the way, she was also revered as a champion by many of the castes of the more common people. Golda, a young Jewish girl from Milwaukee, grew up to become the Golda Meir, Prime Minister of Israel. Some of us may have agreed or disagreed with her politics and her policies, but in the end, she was a determined, accomplished, unbowed leader of an infant nation that she served and led with fierceness and dedication and love. Women did not need to be leaders of nations in order to be leaders of humanity. My pantheon of women of the world would not be complete without recognition of some women whom I admired as a child and whom I continue to hold as saints of humanity. Rosa Parks sat so that others might be able to stand proud. Fannie Lou Hamer was sick and tired of being sick and tired so that others might be able to enjoy their just rest. Dorothy Day started the Catholic Worker House so that those who were down on their luck might not have to be down on their self-esteem, and that they might not be lacking in opportunities for betterment. And Mother Teresa attended to the sickest of the untouchables, shining a light on our common humanity. These women have all found their way into the history that is being taught to our children today, thank goodness. But they were the living companions and leaders of my generation. There were legions that went before them upon whose shoulders these women stood. And there are multitudes who now pick up where they left off. There's one among us here that I want to name to that latter group, and that is our own pillar of the congregation, Janice Maffei. Those of you who've been around for a while will remember that Janice was a past president of our congregation. Many of you may not know, though, that she is a champion far beyond our walls for women and for people everywhere. Janice was the primary director and regional coordinator of Women to Women, an international program dedicated to helping women survivors of war as they go about rebuilding their lives. She served as a facilitator for President Clinton's Global Initiative Conference, which gathers annually together world leaders in order to address some of the planet's more pressing problems with innovative and creative solutions. Janice took part in a women's leadership forum in Chicago a couple of years ago, where a group of prominent women met to launch the National Women's Leadership Initiative, an effort to recruit and engage other women leaders from across the country to work together in support of President Obama. She recently coordinated another program here, Words of Choice, a theatrical presentation promoting the protection of women's reproductive rights. And in her free time, Janice runs a consulting firm, Vision First, and she is also a playwright and an author. Janice Maffei is a woman who is, in fact, a role model for us all. The truth is, there are many women who broke and are breaking through barriers that previously held them and their sisters in subservient roles. The truth is, there are many women who continue to serve in expanding those openings. The truth is that women are now numbered among every profession and manner of life that is obtainable by their male counterparts. So the question is, so why do we need to continue shining a light on women through the observance of National Women's History Month? And of course, the answer is obvious, and it's right in front of our eyes most of the time, but for too many of us, too often, it flies below our radar screen. I suspect that low flying below the screen is more true for men than it is for women, but I suspect it's true of many of us here. So it's important until gender balance is achieved to have International Women's Day and the National Women's History Month. We need such commemorative occasions to draw our attention to truths that can stir our aspirations. When we pay attention to those truths, we see more than the success that gives us a chance to celebrate. We see the cognitive dissonance that lies between who we think we are as a people and the distance we have yet to travel in achieving that ideal. When we pay attention to the plight of women, especially women of lesser means, but not only women of lesser means, we see something of a continuation of a very definite second-class citizen status. This is true not only in the global sense, but nationally as well. According to the National Organization for Women, just these past few months have been brutal in illustrating the gap between the status of men and women in our country. Now goes so far as to declare that the United States Congress is waging war on women. They make clear that House Bill H.R. 1 proposes debilitating cuts to programs that will endanger women's health, undermine vital food programs, erode women's economic security and workforce preparedness, undercut education programs for women and children, and cripple vital housing programs that especially affect women. Many others have characterized the House's actions as being directed at and not for women as well. Pat Walk of the Huffington Post reported that During the recent debate over women's health, 240 members of Congress, mostly men, voted for denying affordable health care to women. At the head of the pack was a congressman from New Jersey, Chris Smith. He has been fighting against women for over three decades, she reports. This outrageous attack on women's health and reproductive rights provoked another member of Congress to speak, Jackie Speer of California, and to reveal that she had undergone an abortion. "I lost my baby," Speer began softly, admonishing House members for graphically describing the procedure she had endured. "But for you to stand on this floor and to suggest, as you have, that somehow this is a procedure that is either welcomed or done cavalierly or done without any thought is preposterous." Annika Rahman, president and CEO of the Ms. Foundation for Women, reported that on Friday, February 18th, the U.S. House of Representatives dealt a crushing blow to the health and well-being of millions of women across America. In a vote of 240 to 185, the House approved H.R. 1, which would prohibit Planned Parenthood from receiving federal funding for any purpose, including providing basic preventive health care to women and families. Consider that a slap in the face to women in general, but especially to low-income women who have nowhere else to turn for their primary health care. And remember that at present, Planned Parenthood provides nearly 4 million tests and treatments for sexually transmitted infections, over 830 breast exams, more than a million pap tests, and it helps to prevent more than 612,000 unintended pregnancies each year. The funding is gone. These are recent reports of attacks at the security of primarily lesser privileged women who are the most vulnerable. The gender gap does not only afflict poor women, though. Its capacity for permeating class and economic boundaries can be easily seen in the dark stories of domestic violence. The National Coalition Against Domestic Violence reports that one in every four women will experience domestic violence in her lifetime, one of every four. An estimated 1.3 million women are victims of physical assault by an intimate partner each year. 85% of domestic violence victims are women. That's horrible. Still another telling illustration of the need to focus on the unfulfilled plight of women in the battle for gender equality is in an area that rarely sees the light of day. It's one that transcends economic, social, ethnic, and all other cultural boundaries. It is the vulnerability of women to even maintain their maternal rights when those rights are being challenged in court. Our own Diane Finn is a social worker and something of an expert on this issue. She tells me that time and again, mothers are stripped of their parenting rights. Those rights are then often awarded by the courts to fathers, regardless of those fathers' capacity to be adequate custodians, even when they have been vindictive and abusive spouses. As Diane puts it, "I have seen the inequality in the family court's handling of women versus men repeatedly in my career as a domestic violence counselor. Men often flout court orders and have no consequences. In the same case, if the woman even appears to have not followed the judge's order, she is threatened with the loss of her children. It is well documented that the court's response to men telling their children negative things about their mother or using children to spy on their mother is minimal to non-existent, while the court's response to moms discussing in any way the behavior of the father is labeled as an attempt at parental alienation by a vindictive, hostile mother." Diane goes on, "This is a reflection of the bias that women are essentially sneaky and vengeful, while men are allowed to be angry and behave in hostile ways because it's just natural male behavior." The issue of the treatment of women and children in the family courts, Diane says, and the way domestic violence in general is handled by the courts, criminal and civil, reflect latent, unexamined bias against women. I don't begin to imagine, and I hope you don't either, that I have provided anything close to an exhaustive list of the ways in which women continue to get, literally and figuratively, the short end of the stick in nearly every aspect of our national and global postmodern consumerist age. The number of examples is truly an endless one. There is some good news, though. And the good news is that in the past year, according to the World Economic Forum, the United States moved from 31st position in the world to 19th in closing at least the economic portion of the gender gap. We have to take our good news where we can get it. The Forum's Global Gender Gap Report has found that although more women are employed than ever before, major corporations are still not capitalizing as well as they might on their talents. Pay equality has not been achieved either. So why are women still not represented in major multinational companies? And when they are, why aren't they being paid equally? The report shows much progress still being made, but a lot of ground left to make up. Co-author of the report, Ricardo Hausman, director of the Center for International Development at Harvard, says countries have to adjust for the fact that marriage and motherhood are not at odds with women's advancement in the workplace. So, what might it mean to be religious in our response to the truths that are given light through such a commemoration of Women's History Month? It could mean that we take heart from the example of women like Eleanor Roosevelt and Fannie Lou Hamer and Janice Maffei and others who have defied limitations placed on them by society and have raised the standard of living for all of us. It could mean that we gain confidence in moving forward by acknowledging the very real progress that we have made in reaching for a balance in gender issues. And I hope that it means that we will pay attention to the distance yet to be traveled, that we will take aim on the obstacles that still remain as impediments to equality, and that we will be inspired by visions of a more loving, a more compassionate, and a more just world, inspired to do better than we have done so far. The truth of the matter is obvious, and it is in front of our eyes all the time. The object is to keep that truth visible. The way lies before us. So let us be on our way. May it be so. And our closing words are by Rebecca Edmondson Lang. Mindful of our highest aspirations, bound by common faith and purpose, and still beginning with ourselves as we are, let us take one more step together in our unending quest for dignity, justice, and love. May the prayers of our hearts and the songs of our lips shared in this holy hour of worship be with us now and in all of our days to come. As we extinguish our chalice, this worship comes to an end and our service begins. Let us take up the service. Blessed be and amen.